new schedule's been all jacked up, and I don't know why.
Yeah, I hear that. I hear that. I was up till 2 a.m. playing Elite Dangerous the other night for no reason.
Elite Dangerous. I don't know if I've heard of that.
It's a space sim combat trading fighting game. Not quite like EVE Online. It's more kind of like solo play, kind of explore the galaxy, a galaxy-sized galaxy, and do whatever you want. There's a little bit of social mechanics in there, but not nearly as much as like EVE would be, where it's like a true MMO, you know?
It's more like... I don't remember the name of that game now. The one that was supposed to be really cool and then came out and everyone's like, oh, this sucks.
Oh, No Man's Sky.
No Man's Sky, that's the one, yeah. It looks like No Man's Sky kind of, but with battles.
Yeah, that's pretty fair. I mean, I was on the No Man's Sky hype train and yeah, we got bored of it after a week, just like everyone, I think.
All right.
I know they've updated it a ton. They're still updating it and like all the updates really look good. I haven't had a chance to get back into No Man's Sky. It's the same concept, like the it's a galaxy-sized galaxy that's procedurally generated, and but they really focus on, I don't want to say realism because obviously it's sci-fi, but there's a lot of detail and control over your ship and the systems and how you like travel between these, you know, different. Obviously, you can't travel them in real time, so they have to kind of hand wavy, faster than light travel things. But the mechanics of it are really cool. And like, you can go to the center of the galaxy, and there's black holes, and there's neutron stars. Like, there's all these real-world astronomical phenomena that you can explore and discover that literally no one else has seen before. Because the place is, I mean, it's gigantic. It's unbelievable. So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah. No Man's Sky, man. I should check that out again. I think we got it on a PS4 when it came out, because it was like an exclusive launch. They had it mechs now. You can, like, walk around in mechs.
Oh, really? Yeah, I really haven't even looked at it since. I played it for a little bit and then stopped playing and haven't really looked. I had a friend that was really, really into it. And he was basically, you know, hype training it up before it released. And then it released and he was like, oh, okay. And he's the only reason I bought it was because he was so excited about it. And yeah, you know, I kind of just stopped playing it and hadn't really looked back.
Shout out 65 Days of Static, who did the soundtrack for the game. And like, that was the thing that really hooked me, was that first couple of trailers that had this awesome, cool, soaring, instrumental post-rock soundtrack. And God, that really just rang me in. And I still really like that kind of music. So that might be up your alley too. Maybe check them out.
Yeah, that's one thing that really pulled me into Minecraft, actually, was the soundtrack by somebody named C418 or C418. It's just good music. It's good working music, rating music, relaxing music. He's put out many more records than just what the Minecraft soundtrack is, but the Minecraft soundtrack is really good. So you're just sort of decompressing after work and you find yourself just listening to this, I don't know, chill atmospheric music and running around. It's pretty relaxing.
I always liked in Minecraft when that music starts playing, and it's sort of, because it is so minimalist, it kind of comes out of nowhere. Like, the Minecraft doesn't have a lot of real ambient sound besides punching trees and walking around, and so when the music comes in, you get these little plink 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 plink,
yeah,
piano,
yeah,
keys that really it kind of gets you off guard at first. You're like, ah, what's happening? But man, yeah, it really suits the game so well. I think it's really, really interesting how that kind of came together. I think that kind of marriage of that music with Minecraft.
I think the music actually comes in when it's like time to change from day to night or night to day. It like signifies certain events, I think. It's not sort of like an ambient. And actually more...
Is that true?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. And more recently, what I've done actually is turn the music down and I'll play my own music in the background if I'm wanting to hang out. Or sometimes I'll listen to a podcast and run around, but... I'm pretty sure that most of the music in that game actually signifies like some sort of event that's happening.
That would make sense, but I've never been able to draw the or connect the dots between what's happening and
right
what music is occurring.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's how it is. It's like time to go to bed or time to wake up, sort of like music.
Another one of my favorite game soundtracks is from the game Braid.
Braid.
Which is a sort of puzzle platformer. It's pretty short, game, indie game, very cool painted art style with time manipulation mechanics as part of the puzzle solving. The music in that is like, it felt so like I came to associate this music so well with the game because of the time mechanics of the game, you can run and jump and do something forward, and then you can actually like rewind time and certain things get undone, but certain things don't. And so the music will play backward as you're going backwards in time and forwards as you're going forward in time at different speeds and stuff, right? It kind of ramps up and ramps down, and whatever the music that he chose is very organic and had lots of strings and cellos and harps and all these things that were very organic sounds that kind of lended themselves to sort of enhance the gameplay, because you can hear them kind of go and right. And I just assumed that they had developed the music for the game, but it's just like an indie solo, probably developer, small shop. And it was all just, not royalty free, but like stock music that you could just get the license to. And he built this really cool soundtrack for the game off of stock music. And it just enhanced it so much. It just really, really blew my mind.
That's cool. I think there are even add-ons that you can, or like client-side add-ons that you can add to Minecraft, where you can add more realistic sounds and give different types of biomes, different sounds. So if you're in the desert, it'll sound different than if you're in a forest or in a nice biome. So there's like the Minecraft community is so gigantic. There's like a mod or an add-on that you can add for almost anything. And so when I play on my PC, I actually have some shaders installed that give it realistic lighting and shadows. And it makes water look more realistic too. And it's kind of trippy to look at, like, cause my main house that I hang out at is on an island. So it's a very small island. So it's basically just like a block of sand and then this house. So it's kind of trippy to see like this blocky house and then like actual kind of like water waves flowing around it. But,
yeah, the juxtaposition of a 1 meter resolution with right, hyper realistic graphics and shading and shadows
and that night with like the moon out and there's like moon rays coming through the trees and stuff and there's like a torch that's like flickering and there's real shadows. It's kind of, it is strange, sort of uncanny valley, but it's kind of, I don't know, it's been really relaxing for me lately, which has been awesome.
That's cool. I know Jess has been really sucked in. She's just been playing nonstop on the server for a couple weeks now.
Her property has expanded to encompass the spawn, so when someone new spawns in the server, they land in her castle.
Paul has this cool plugin for the server that lets you go to a web browser and see the like the top down view and like a isometric view of the whole area of the server, and yeah, when you go to spawn it's like this giant castle.
That map is cool. I mean, there's just so much, there's so many add-ons, and it's what's really cool is that it's all open source, so you can just go and look at it. I mean, it's all Java, but you can go look at anything, and DynMap specifically, what you're talking about, is cool because it's all real-time, so when people are on the server, you could just go on your web browser and look to see where people are and they're moving, and then if you're playing, you can kind of use it as a compass, so you can zoom way out onto the map, and there's Fog of War, so you can't see where you haven't gone yet, but you can zoom way out on the map and kind of tell like where you're going. Cause we've progressed far enough on the server where everyone has wings. We've kind of found wings for everybody and we built a farm. So now we basically have unlimited fireworks. And so you can actually fly, you can propel yourself with these bottle rockets. So now everyone's just flying to like the edges of the map. And on DynMap, you can sort of use that as a real time sort of compass to see which way you're going.
So I have a funny story. Back when I was working at Agilent, I became friends with another guy about my age who ran his own Minecraft server. And by ran his own server, I'm just talking about like a VPS somewhere. Like he bought and leased a physical hardware slot in a rack somewhere in a data center, right? He was paying for a real, honest to God, physical server all to himself, all the resources, right?
Yeah.
And he could do this is because he had amassed like this community of people who played on the server, and just occasionally they would donate to his PayPal. it was more than enough to cover the costs of running the server. It was crazy. And the way he was able to do that was because he installed a bunch of plugins, but he also developed his own plugins. I mean, there's just Java. You just conform to some Java interfaces and you load some stuff in there.
Right.
And so he wrote his own plugins for like managing money, and wallets and protecting like areas of your, you know, protecting your property. So like you draw your own property lines and then people can't grief you by messing with it, stuff like that. It was just so cool. And it was so funny because he was kind of like this higher tier, like he was on a higher plane of all these other players. So he almost never logged into his own server.
Yep.
And so I was like, hey, can you show me this thing? This is cool. So he logs in and everyone's like, oh, Mark, you're here. Oh my God. And they're all like mobbing him and freaking out. Cause like he never shows up. He's just this admin that occasionally comes in but what we were doing, we were trying to develop some custom plugin and we needed a data store to back it, right? You need some kind of persistence. So when the server crashes or goes down or you migrate or whatever, you need to all the state to be maintained. So we're developing this custom plugin and we're like, what's this MongoDB thing? This might be kind of cool. It's just documents, man. You just kind of throw stuff into it and you get stuff out. And it seemed to be like this really good solution for we don't really need a schema. We don't need migrations. We're just trying to just store data in a database and kind of get it back out. And it seemed like a really flexible way to do that and add features over time.
Mm-hmm.
And we could also cluster it as well, right? So I think it wasn't clustering, but really you could subscribe to every single sort of mutation to the MongoDB store. Mm-hmm. So you get the stream of events. Like every time a document gets updated, you can be notified of that, right? Just from a DB connection.
Right.
I think Postgres does this too. So we did that. And so that way, whenever a change occurred, we could pick it up and sort of do stuff with the plugin to, you know, reconcile that state.
Yeah, Postgres does have a PubSub built into it as well. I think with Phoenix, it uses Postgres PubSub anyway. Because when I was messing around with LiveView stuff, that's what I used for updating the UI was PubSub with Phoenix.
That's true. I'd forgotten about that. This is more like not so much PubSub, but really just being notified of changes.
Oh, just like subscriptions, like actual subscriptions.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But what was funny was we started building this out and then we started hitting all the problems with the document store. How do we index things? How do we ensure referential integrity?
Mm-hmm.
What happens if the shape of the data changes? And all these things started compiling on and we basically just lost steam and stopped developing this plugin. But it was a learning experience for sure.
Well, it's stuff like that that got me into programming in the first place through high school, right? Like wanting to make games or wanting to make a plugin for a game, and that's what got me into coding originally. Maybe that's why I have such a fondness for games that allow extension that much, is because that's sort of what got me, or at least like helped start to get me where I am right now.
Dude, did you ever see Notch's other game that he was working on after Minecraft?
No, but I've heard a few people mention it.
It was called OX1C, I think. Yeah, OX10C, pronounced 10 to the C. Yeah, I'll link it in the show notes. This was pretty wild concept. So obviously after doing Minecraft, Marcus, also known as Notch, was just, you know, kind of at the top of his game and he wanted to just try to do something different with his time. And so this game was supposed to be a space exploration game, kind of like I was describing before, except the core gameplay was centered around your ship as a CPU, like a very, very simple CPU. And I'm talking about like really, really primitive instructions, like all the stuff you would do if you were writing assembly, basically. Like the functionality of your ship was programmed using assembly. Basically, he made up his own instruction set. He made up his own operating system, sort of, for like interfacing with it. And part of the game was like enabling disabling modules, because different modules, depending on how complex the program was, would draw more energy from your ship. And so you had to sort of manage that.
Hmm.
But what was cool about it was it's like a sneaky way of learning assembly. Like you get really, really into it. My friend of mine who I grew up with, not a programmer, but he's a huge gamer and was working on, you know, got the beta of this game and they provided like a demo, basically a virtual machine that you could run your programs on. And he didn't realize it, but he's like, he basically wrote like an entire text editor and like all this crazy stuff in just assembly, just because it was a game. And like, I'm walking him through it because I had taken all this stuff in college and like this, I had a cursory knowledge of it. What a cool concept that unfortunately never went anywhere. But I really like that sort of subversive teaching technique where it's like, oh shoot, I did learn something.
Yeah, it sort of removes the mundaneness of it. Like, I guess if you're really excited about something, it's easier to keep it in memory and easier to spend more hours doing it, which means that it's easier to memorize stuff.
Human resource machine on all kinds of platforms, including consoles and iOS and everything. Switch, I think, is also another good, fun game that actually teaches you assembly, but it kind of vets itself as a puzzle game.
Oh, I've not heard of this.
If you're interested in that.
Yeah, I might need to check this out. With all of the time that I have.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
7 Billion Humans is the sequel, which is basically the same thing, but parallelized. So you like teach yourself parallel optimizations of things. It's out of control, man. Anyway, you haven't been playing any games lately. I haven't seen you on Minecraft. What have you been doing over there, man?
Well, sitting on the admin panel for Minecraft, like you mentioned earlier, I'm looking at it right now. I can see that...
playing God.
Yeah, I can see that Jess earned the advancement voluntary exile, so she hasn't been hanging out in town often, it looks like. I've just been busy.
She's keeping socially distant.
Yeah, she's being responsible and she's building her kingdom. Yeah. I've been real busy. A lot of stuff happening here. A lot of changes happening here. Good changes, I think, but lots of changes. Don't even know where to start, really. I guess we can start with, like, I've been learning Go.
Oh, yeah?
Well, so I started learning Go a little bit. Like, I don't even want to say like learning Go. I started kicking around a little project for fun with Go because I wanted to learn a strongly typed language. And I know a couple of people that write Go, and so I just ended up trying to work with it. No real reason why I picked it over C# or anything like that, but yeah. So it turns out that I've had a opportunity come across my plate, and nothing's set in stone, nothing's finalized, so I'll kind of speak a little bit cryptically about it, but have been going through some interviews and some code challenges, and those are all based on Go, because that's the stack that I would potentially be working with, and so I guess specifically the last week I've been so quiet is because I had a code test with Go where I had to build an API from scratch, and had number of criteria around that, number of things that I needed to satisfy. So basically I needed to learn Go as fast as I could, or enough Go rather, to satisfy the code test to continue on with the interview cycle.
Can we put a link to that project in the show notes or no?
Oh God. I mean, yeah, I can. I don't think I mentioned anything specifically about who, it's probably fine to mention it. I just don't want to yet because nothing's finalized. But yeah, I will actually pull it up right here. I have mixed feelings on the project, but.
Well, we should back up a little bit.
Okay.
So first of all, I think this is really, really cool that you were given a sort of take-home project as part of this interview process because, obviously it's remote. I don't think you had to go anywhere to do these interviews.
Right.
But whiteboard problem solving of things is, I think, considered by most developers is kind of not very productive in terms of determining actual quality of a developer. So I think take home project is awesome. Just right off the bat, I think this is great, especially because not only does it test sort of show your ability to write the code, but also you get to go through the process. I mean, you knew basically zero about Go when you started this, and now you know maybe 1% of Go. But like, fair. You have to go through that process and find the documentation and learn about the state of the art and what tools you need. It was really cool to sort of hear about the process that you're going through, and obviously we're comparing it to Elixir and Phoenix, mm-hmm. with what you're doing here. It's a web application, it's a API. It's kind of apples and apples.
Well, I can start by breaking down what the actual code test was. So basically, they wanted me to build an API that is basically like a catalog manager, like for music. So the criteria was there needed to be 4 tables. So like music, tracks, artists, albums, and genres. And they had to be related somehow. And there had to be CRUD methodology, you know, create, read, update, delete, etc. for any or all of those resources. And that was it. So, you know, they told me what parts of it they would be interested in. They told me that, you know, the database design was up to me, that like what libraries I used were up to me. If I used a framework at all, that was up to me. And they just sort of left it pretty open-ended. So basically, I think they just sort of wanted to get a picture of like what my decision-making was like and go from there. So it was really difficult because I spent about 3 days kicking around different libraries and packages. And so I was at least familiar with Go syntax, you know, basic things like how to make different types, how to make structs, how to use arrays and slices and how to handle errors and, you know, the basic sort of syntax stuff. Now, beyond that, I think what was the most daunting was trying to learn a little bit about the ecosystem. From what I know so far about Go is there's a very pragmatic approach. And one thing I learned through this project is how much I take advantage of from the Elixir and Phoenix and Ecto ecosystem, more specifically like Ecto. So with Phoenix, and when you make like a new Phoenix app, it comes with Ecto. You get migrations, like database migrations out of the box. You have ways to do not only like, you know, mutating and changing the database structure itself, but you could actually handle data migrations up along with a migration if you needed to. You get sandbox testing out of the box. You get a test environment database out of the box. You get just so much stuff.
Plug in the router.
And so with Go, it's sort of more often than not, it's more of like the node approach where you don't sort of have like these main blessed solutions. Like if you're making web API, like 90%, you're going to use Phoenix. There are other options, but mostly you just use Phoenix. With Ruby, you know, Rails is a big one. I mean, obviously Sinatra is pretty big too, or things like that. But, you know, many people just use Rails. If you're doing Ruby, you're just using Rails. Go, there are a couple of analogs to maybe Rails, but none of them are as mature. Certainly, and none of them have the same sort of market share within the ecosystem that Rails or Phoenix would have. You know, so I looked briefly at something like Buffalo, which would probably be the closest to Rails. It sort of comes with migrations and DB and ORM and stuff out of the box. There's another one called Echo, I guess, but that would be similar to even like Express, you know, so DB is not included, you know. So that was the most intimidating thing to me is, you know, I'm over here in Phoenix land, just like slinging apps together, and I come to Go and suddenly I'm forced to make these decisions. Which ORM do I want to use? Which even down to like which router do I want to use? Just a lot of decisions to be made.
Do you think what's the primary reason for that? Do you think, is it because the ecosystem is so new and maybe a clear winner hasn't emerged? Or do you think it's more just the mentality of the developers?
Partially mentality. I don't think that's because the ecosystem is so new. I think it more stems from the mentality, and I don't mean that to be a negative thing. Go is a much closer to being a lower level language, I would say, than Elixir is. In fact, like Go is like really close to C. It's like almost a derivative of C in a sense. So I think that I'm speaking in generalities, and again, I'm like a newcomer to the ecosystem, so I could be speaking out of turn here, but this is, I guess I'll preface this with, this is just feels like my observations from what I've listened to and read. And it just seems like Go, the general focus has been on pragmatism. So the Go standard library packages comes with everything you would technically need to make a web API or a web app. And I think before that, there wasn't even a big focus on making web-specific apps with Go, because it is such a lower-level language. There's many more things you can do with it. It's not necessarily geared towards being like a web language. But the standard library packages has everything you would need. So it has a SQL package. It has a router package. It has a template package. Go ships with all that stuff.
Well, here's the thing. Ruby ships with all that stuff too, but it's all crap and you're not supposed to use it.
Well, I think on the flip side is, yeah, the standard package stuff there's a lot of caveats and sort of sharp edges there, but people tend to, from what I've read, push you towards just using them. So the consensus, or what, again, more often what I've seen than not in Googling and reading, is people are like, well, why do I need A, B, or C when the standard library has this built in? And of course, there are going to be edge cases. Like the standard library router doesn't route things how you would presume. So actually, there's a bunch of edge cases around a trailing slash or a non-trailing slash. The router will do very different things based on just a trailing slash in a route.
Oh,
so,
God.
There are lots of things like that, but the mentality I've seen so far has just been like, yeah, it's, we'll just learn that and then use it. Like, you don't need anything extra here. And I think the general consensus or mentality has been, I would rather spend 6 weeks up front building this all myself and I know exactly how it works, as opposed to spending 2 weeks up front with a framework and then for the next 4 weeks fighting it to get exactly what I need out of it.
That's really interesting because, I could see definitely both arguments for that, especially coming from having done Phoenix now for a while. And Phoenix does give you a lot out of the box, but everything is explicit and it gives you escape hatches for everything. Mm-hmm. So it's really easy to go against the grain and design things how you want, if you want to. Yeah, I definitely see the appeal of sort of building things up yourself, because every application is different and you're going to have different requirements. And as long as you know what those are ahead of time and you anticipate that and you know the tools, I think that's probably a better way to go. It does make it harder to sort of work with other people, bring new people on, communicate your ideas, right? Because you don't have this common verbiage and way to talk about the structure of your app, maybe, because it's this own custom thing. But maybe that's okay. Maybe it's not a big deal. Yeah, I go back and forth on this stuff so often these days because, man, when I hop into Rails, I feel so productive so I can just get crap done and get in and get out. But when I need that flexibility, it falls short there. So, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, even if you look at the standard library, like the testing package that comes with it even has like built-in benchmarking tools. So I think a big focus of the community for a long time has been, like, performance is paramount. That's what we're doing here. So developer productivity can maybe take a backseat to that performance is paramount sort of setup. Now, I did listen to a podcast from the GoTime podcast, and they had one of the maintainers, or the maintainer of the Buffalo framework that I mentioned earlier, on. And he was sort of talking about this. So maybe I might link to that for some added context here with people that have been around the ecosystem for much, much longer than I have. Again, I've only been around for a couple of weeks. But that was sort of what he was saying too. And he was saying that there's more developers coming in that are sort of valuing the other side of it, valuing the developer productivity, e.g. like the Rails style scaffolding and deal with other stuff later. And that's why you start to have projects like Buffalo coming up that sort of make the decisions for you. So even Buffalo, like, the whole thing isn't written from scratch. They have a lot of stuff they've written from scratch, but they're like, well, this package for auth is good over here, so we're going to use that. And this package over here is good for that, so we're going to pull that in. And so it's sort of more like a, all right, well, we've made these choices for you on which libraries we like and are well-maintained, and we'll work together with how we think this project should run. And so when you choose Buffalo, you get sort of a set of first-party packages and another set of third-party packages that are first-party in consideration and how they work with Buffalo. So the landscape is changing a little bit in that regard. But for the purposes of my code test, you know, I didn't really want to use something that was that full stack. I wanted to go something a little bit more closer to the metal, because I didn't really want to just be gluing stuff together in a code test. So yeah, the first 3 days were me just like putting stuff in and tearing it out, getting frustrated and tearing stuff out, like different routers.
How many times did you restart this?
Twice. Well, once actually. So the first half of the week, you know, I was, you know, working full time, so I was busy. So it wasn't like an extreme amount of time that I put into this. But I think on Friday morning, I just started a new one, and I was like, right, these are the two things I'm going to use, and this is what I'm building on top of. So, but at that point, I think I got the assignment on Tuesday, and so like Wednesday and Thursday, I was kicking around different packages, and on Friday morning, I had made a decision on which things I was going to build on.
So let's back up a little bit. How's the tooling and everything else sort of around the language? I mean, the package management and the VS Code plugins, I assume, or excuse me, not VS Code, whatever the heck friggin' thing you're using over there.
Yeah, I just use IntelliJ. I mean, JetBrains has GoLand, which is an IDE that's specifically focused on Go, but you can just install the Go package into IntelliJ. The VS Code plugin is also really good. I don't know. I mean, I think Microsoft actually maintains it, so that helps. But also, it's a strongly typed language, so I think just out of the box, you're going to get some just really good tooling because of that. So yeah, IntelliJ helped me through things a lot. And I guess like, okay, so another aspect of Go is that there seems to be a lot of emphasis on code generation. And so when I heard that or read that the first time, I was like, okay, well, that Elixir does similar, you know, like we have compile time code generation with macros and stuff. Well, this is different. This is like run a command to build it. And then you just keep the source code in your project. You just check it in when you're using it. And that was very new to me, but I went around and I was trying a few different ORMs and I didn't really jive with any of them, like Gorm and Gorp and Zorm and all these wild names. And there's even one that's pretty decent called Golang PG. It's like it's just some add-ons on top of the built-in SQL standard library package. But I found one called SQL Boiler that basically is code gen. So with SQL Boiler, you connect it to your database. And SQL Boiler doesn't have any sort of like migrations or anything. So you tell it how to connect your database, you run the generator, and it literally generates a full on ORM statically into your project, into whatever folder you tell it to. So in my case, I had 8 tables, right? So four regular tables and 4 join tables. And it picked up the relationships and everything fine, and the code was just hanging out in a models folder. And what that ended up amounting to was actually like really good productivity, because it was so transparent and clear. Like if I had a question about how something worked, I just go to that folder and the function's sitting right there. There wasn't any number of like levels of indirection that I had to sort of jump through. It's just the source code is there.
Yeah. Active Record does this implicitly and you have no idea what's going on because it's all under the hood. But here you can literally just set a breakpoint if you want.
Yeah, and it even includes like set ops, so you could actually have it in certain nested relationships and stuff. So I actually use that a little bit. So my database design basically centered on tracks. So a track can have many artists, can have many albums, can have many genres. And I was actually looking at Spotify when I was thinking about this, and I was looking at it, and it's like, okay, well, tons of records these days, each track has like a different feature on it. And if you click on the artist name, that track is actually listed under that artist's, the feature's discography, even though they're not the primary artist, so to speak. So it seems like you're jumping from relation to relationship in Spotify really quickly. And it's no longer that like one track has one artist and one genre. It's like a track can have, like if you look at Post Malone's last record, like one track might be rock and next track might be like trap or something like that. So I thought it was important that tracks needed to be flexible with genres. Albums needed to be flexible with genres and artists and things like that. So anyway,
you listen to a lot of Post Malone these days?
Sometimes, I don't know. Sometimes it's like good background work music, but yeah, I plugged SQL Boiler into it and it spat out this folder of models and it just worked. It was pretty cool. I wanted to say that specifically because it made me, again, not super familiar with like advanced Go and using interfaces in elegant ways. And because I wasn't, you know, an advanced Go or even an immediate Go programmer, I didn't want to try to be fancy with something I didn't really understand how to use well. So I went this SQL, like I went this code gen route. And I commented everything. I was like, okay, well, this is happening here. This is why it's happening here. And the source is right over here. And it turns out that in my code reviews, they really appreciated that, because even though, you know, none of the people actually looking at the code base were advanced Go programmers or anything like that, they're like, oh, I was able to understand it. And I was able to understand why certain decisions are made a certain way. And I was able to follow things around. And I feel like if I would have tried to jump in beyond like what I felt comfortable doing, I guess it wouldn't have turned out that way. And so it ended up working really well. I was sort of scared of being like, all right, well, here's a generated thing that I didn't write, you know, but it turned out that they really appreciated that. After I explained why I made that choice, like, oh, it makes complete sense now as to why you chose to go that route.
When you're talking about comments, I'm looking through your models directory here. There's a bunch.
Don't look at it.
No, there's a bunch of comments in the generated files. Did you put those in there by hand, or is the generator put those in? Okay, those are all just pre-generated. Okay.
Yeah, so it generates like everything. It generates association queries. It generates inserts and updates and upserts. It generates documentation for it. So in my thinking, like if I'm coming in and I'm joining a smallish team of say like 10 people, and I'm doing a project like this, this seems to me like a really decent way to approach this problem, because anyone can jump in and see everything right there. It's plain as day. Right. And like you said, with Active Record, it's like levels and levels of indirection, levels and levels of jumping around. And with this approach, it is right there. It is what it says on the tin. If we have to make a change, like say later, like I did, I ended up adding a migration library. And so I can migrate the database up and down. Well, you just rerun that function and then you could actually see a diff of how the ORM changed. So again, there's no magic. Right. It's like sort of forcing you to deal with it, which I felt like was a very Elixir approach to that in spirit, I guess, or a very Phoenix approach to it. And it turned out, like, again, I was kind of scared to commit that. And they asked me about it, like, why CodeGen? And I explained it. And they're like, that makes sense.
Now, this isn't the only place you use CodeGen in this project.
Right. So the other place was with actually the GraphQL interface, because I wanted to go with GraphQL. And there's a project called GQLGen. And similar to SQL Boiler, you can set up a schema.graphql file and it generates the basically your queries and mutations for you. And so basically what you do then is go through and implement the resolvers and implement the actual sort of like business logic of the operations. And again, I went that route because actually before that, I had actually built out some of the REST API just sort of myself using a package. And I just like working with GraphQL better. So I switched but also they had the same feedback on GQL Gen. They're like, well, this makes a lot of sense. Like, you know, you're going to have that sort of source of truth for your schemas anyway. So it makes sense to generate it. If you have a SQL or a schema.graphql file, it makes sense to just generate the boilerplate. So I guess that's what all I was trying to do is get the boilerplate out of the way, because that doesn't matter if I write it or if I don't write it. What matters is the actual business logic of this application, is it clear and concise and easy to navigate around? And the feedback I got was, yeah, it was. And, you know, again, like I said, I was sort of a little bit scared to use code generation so much, but it ended up working out really well. And the people that were reviewing this, like I said, aren't expert Go programmers, but they had a technical background and they were still able to reason about things. So that felt pretty good. And really, like, they were more concerned about my database design anyway. You know, so in my migrations, I have cascading deletes for the join table records. And that doesn't mean that a cascading delete will go from a track to an artist. It just means that it'll go from a track to its associated artists on the join table. And so we talked about that for a while, you know, like why cascading here? So I talked about, you know, data cleanup, like I don't want to leave a bunch of junk tables around, especially if the primary key column is indexed. You know, if you don't clean that up, or if there's a bug that causes you not to clean it up, well, then you can't reestablish that relationship later until that row is deleted. And then I, you know, of course I was like, now if this were on a larger team or a larger project, I might not go there out because it might need to be in the code, because if you're doing stored procedures and things like that and triggers in the database, and everyone has to be aware that it's there. It adds a level of indirection, right? You have to be aware. You have to kind of like look at the database schema to know that it's there. They were fine with that answer. They're like, yeah, that makes sense. You know, as long as all they wanted to know is, as long as I, or all they wanted to know is that I was aware that if it was a bigger application and more developers, things like that are generally can be dangerous.
So I'm looking at your migration here and it's just a raw .sql file, just a plain old list of SQL instructions, which I think is great. I think this is awesome. What is Goose? Is Goose the thing that runs the migrations and manages it for you?
Yeah, Goose is just a runner, basically. Yep.
So there's a line on here at the very bottom. It says Goose. Well, at the top, there's Goose up, right, for creating your migration. Goose up. And at the very bottom, Goose down. Mm. Sean, these people are out of control with their terrible library names.
Yep.
This is inexcusable.
It's very, yeah, there are several.
There's such a thing as being too clever, damn it.
There are several different libraries out there and different approaches. One of them uses whatever.up.sql and whatever.down.sql, but I was having trouble getting that working. I ended up dockerizing the whole thing, which actually was a big bonus, I suppose, that they liked that a lot. But I ended up using Goose because I was having some sort of problem getting the the built executable. So like when you run go build some go file, it actually makes an executable that you can run, right? So it kind of packages everything up. It's just one executable file. So I was having trouble getting, I think it's called Postgres Migrate, or I can't remember. I'll have to put the link in the show notes, but I was having trouble getting access to that executable or having the executable build when I was deploying, and I didn't have any troubles with Goose. So there's probably some very specific reason for that, but that's why I use Goose. I would prefer to have them in different files, definitely, but this is what we have now.
Goose down. God damn it.
Yeah. And I mean, with Go 1.0, I don't remember exactly what version it is, but recently they just released Go modules. And before there were a number of community ways of sort of managing your dependencies, but now Go sort of has it built in with Go modules. And so that also sort of made it difficult because half the time I was Googling outside of the standard library or documentation, it was all over the map, whether like the person had updated their README to be compatible with Go modules or not. So that was fun. But really, like, the hardest part about this whole project was A, remaining confident in, like, I know what I'm doing. I know like what the end result is going to be, and it's going to be decent. And I know how to get there. And I think really that was because, you know, again, I'm so used to Phoenix and Ecto sort of doing so much for you. And with Go, without picking something like Buffalo, you just have to make those choices and you have to plug them in yourself and use them yourself. So it's sort of a lot to sort of decide on up front. But I think it ended up working out okay. This is certainly not a great app, and I don't like that you're looking at it because I don't like to look at it. I'll probably hack on it over the weekend for more learning, but
I don't even know half of what I'm looking at, dude. It's you're totally safe here. I can't speak for our listeners, though. They can tear it apart.
Right, sure. I mean, yeah, that's probably good. Like, I just need to learn. At this point, I just need to be writing. And like I said, nothing is set in stone. I've gone through 4 interviews now in a code test, and I have 2 more interviews next week. So we'll see what happens. But in the meantime, like, I'm enjoying reading and writing Go. And I think like this is the best case scenario for learning Go because, like you said earlier, like if you have a real interest or reason to build something, it makes it easier to learn the thing that you're building. Because before I learned Rails the first time, I had tried a couple of times and never really got the grasp of it. And then when I was at Octopus, I got assigned a Rails app and I didn't have a choice. And suddenly I learned Rails, you know? And so I think that this is the same situation for me with Go and learning typed languages and learning. You know, I've been writing Elixir way longer than I had written Ruby. So at this point, like interfaces, I'm sort of starting from ground zero again. You know, they're similar to behaviors, but it's different in Go. And even on top of that, Go isn't really an object-oriented language. You do inheritance through composition. So instead of having large interfaces and stuff, the interface in Go is literally just a, here's what it's called, here's the input, and here's the output. However you implement, it's up to you. And so you end up having a type with very small interfaces and you end up composing them together, right? So I guess I got lucky because even that's similar to Elixir, like with behaviors, and it's not a strictly object-oriented language, but it still feels like starting from ground zero in that respect.
Did you find any particularly good resources that helped you, whether it's books or websites or tutorials or just the docs itself? What was the biggest help for you when you were trying to figure this stuff out?
Yeah, so there is a repo I'll put in the show notes. It's called Learn Go with Test-Driven Development. And this is a great, great utility.
Oh, thank God it's not called Awesome Go.
Well, there's one of those. There's several of those too.
Of course there is.
But this repository is great because it takes you through all the building blocks of Go and it walks you through writing the tests as well. So you go through it and then you spin up a new Go project on your own. It walks you through it. You generate the test for it. And you just continue on. So there's that. I also bought the book Go in Action, which is okay. But really, I think like something like Learn Go with Tests and then having a project that you need to build is probably the best way to go about it. And if you've built web apps before, just rebuild one of the ones you've done in the past. And that's a really good way to go about it.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. When people always ask me, friends and stuff ask me, what language should I learn? Or I'm like, well, what project do you want to work on? And work backwards from there.
Right. Yeah, that'll get you really far and it removes some of the questions in your mind. I mean, I did go through and look at, like, I browsed through most of the standard library packages. There's quite a few of them, like I said, and that's really helpful. So I think, like, starting at you know, the basic types and then some of the interface stuff, and then looking at maybe like some of the number packages or string conversion packages that it has, and especially the testing. Go has some really interesting, different approach to testing than say like XUnit does. So literally how you do it is you have a function, it starts with test. So if you have hello world function, you have test hello world, that's a test for it. And then that testing function takes a pointer to testing, t.testing, and then it's like, okay, well, what do I do now? So basically you just write code, and then if there's an error, something happens that you don't expect, you just actually throw a t.error format string and then spit out whatever. You actually write your error messages for the most part. So it's very, like I said, it's very different from what I'm used to. But I think like going that route, it would be probably a good way to go, is doing the test-driven development approach.
This is cool. Are there any particular language features or any cool kind of mind-blowing things that the language does that you really, really liked? Something that maybe you hadn't seen before you felt really was pretty unique and cool?
Test tables are cool. I hadn't seen that before.
What's a test table?
So if you have a testing function, you might have like one assertion, and Go by itself doesn't even, like, the testing package doesn't even have like an assert function. Like I said, you literally say if input or what I want, or if X does not equal Y, if you want X to equal Y, you say if X does not equal Y, T dot error. And then you say like, this is what I wanted here. So you might have like, say you have a sum function and you just want to assert that the sum function works properly over a range of different like numbers. Like maybe it's an integer, maybe it's integer 64, integer 32, maybe it's a float, whatever. Instead of writing your own loop to do that, there's a thing called a test table. And so the test table, if I remember correctly, like you basically set up a struct. You basically have a slice of maps. So you have like input and expected, right? So say you have 10 inputs and 10 expected. You'd have a slice of 10 elements in that. A slice meaning like a variable sized array. That's all I mean. And then you write the function to write the test. And so Go will actually run over all the cases for you. So it's basically a built-in sort of like for loop for asserting many inputs and outputs over the same verification function. I don't know if any of that made sense, but I thought it was cool.
It's kind of like, is that like property testing? I don't quite know property testing, but it kind of sounds like that.
Kind of, yeah. It doesn't, well, this doesn't generate all the values for you. Like I think of some property libraries might, but yeah, it's similar where you can basically just write the verification function once, and then you can just keep adding to the slice of test conditions that you want to test, and it'll just do that for you.
Okay, and there's a special syntax for defining those individual cases.
Yep. The other cool thing was example tests too. So similar to Elixir, where in documentation you can sort of have it run tests, this is a little bit different, but they have this thing called example tests. So again, if you have a function called hello world, you can call example hello world. And if you format a comment in a certain way, under the whatever you're asserting, and then you generate your documentation with GoDoc, you can actually run those examples in the documentation it generates.
Kind of like test docs in Elixir?
Well, kind of, but you can actually run them in the browser and stuff.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, it's interesting. And then it shows like when it generates the documentation, it shows like it shows it in line underneath it too. So it's pretty cool. Yeah, it's there's some neat things about it. It's definitely very different. Pointers are still a trip for me to work with sometimes. But and then like, you know, having to make sure that like, even though you have maybe like a slice of artists, a pointer to a slice of artists is different than an actual value of slice to artists. And so you have to remember to like convert the address to a value and back and forth sometimes if you need to. And it depends on really like GQL gen likes to pass pointers around, but you can turn that off. Yeah. I don't know. It's just a new thing for me to figure out, pointers in general. But, I don't know, like Go felt intimidating at first, 'cause it feels like a low level language. You have like the types to worry about. At first I was like, how do you filter and how do you map and reduce stuff? Well, you don't, you just use a for loop. That's all you got is a for loop. And that's one of the, I guess, core tenets of Go, is that it's a very, very simple language. There are only like a couple of dozen keywords in the whole thing. So if you need to loop over something, there's no list comprehensions, there's no filter or functional constructs. You just got a for loop, and you just make do with that. So there is a lot of repetition, a lot of repeated code, but in looking at it, it's like the same things are sort of done all over the place. So you're not going to be running into like all these patterns that you've never seen before. When you look from Go app to Go app, it's going to be relatively the same across apps.
Well, I think that makes a lot of sense because you mentioned at the beginning, like performance above everything is kind of one of the core tenets mm-hmm. of the language. And if you only have a couple of constructs and ways to do things, it's really easy for the compiler to optimize that stuff and make it really, really fast. And it's, you know, kind of close to the metal. I mean, doing for loops is something you can do in C and C++. And, you know, you can almost go one for one with, like, you know exactly what the underlying instruction codes are going to be for that when you actually compile it
right.
in most cases. So I could totally see why that would be the case. Like, you don't want a bunch of different ways to filter a list because it's going to be really, really hard to optimize the case for that. Why don't you just do a little bit of extra work up front? Let the compiler do the right thing when it sees that pattern.
Yeah, and I think the other part to think about is like Go is coming from a lot of the Go designers are coming from like C and C++, which has like gigantic, massive, sprawling APIs. Right, it's huge, huge language, and so Go is like the exact opposite of that. It's very simple, very small, very pragmatic.
But the standard library, you said, is still pretty comprehensive, I guess, right?
The standard library is, but how they do it is like it's split up into packages. So you still have to import package. I guess it's similar to Elixir where you have to like alias or import enum or list or you know, other standard library things. Like Go is broken up into individual packages as well. So even the packages are like really small and scoped in isolation.
I gotcha.
Yeah. But so that's why I haven't been playing any games because I'm like cramming Go into my brain.
Well, good luck with the rest of your interviews. I hope things go well
Thanks.
For you over there. It sounds like things are going fine. I'm not worried.
Yeah, things are fine.
You shouldn't be worried.
Yeah, I mean, either way, you know, things are fine. Like, I've talked with Lindsay. I told Lindsay before I even, like, formally started pursuing the offer. You know, everything's good. Like, there's no secrecy. Like, I just didn't really want to say the company that I'm interviewing with just because nothing's set in stone. And
well, here's the deal. Either way, no matter how it turns out, we'll have an interesting episode next week.
Yeah, hopefully. Hopefully.
That's good, though. We're all rooting for you, man. It's going to be cool to have something new to talk about on the show, man. I'm really looking forward to... I mean, listen, we could do the compare and contrast thing all day, but I'm really curious to hear about what the process is like for you for learning a whole new tool set and a new team and a new project, new product, new... you know, situation and everything. I mean, you've got your routine pretty settled in here. Mm-hmm. Who knows how that's going to change? I mean, you're still working remotely, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's not going to be too bad of a change, but you know, who knows when they expect you. I assume they're West Coasters. Well, you're on the West Coast, so it doesn't matter.
Teams all over the place, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's pretty distributed, but yeah, it'll be interesting. Like I said, if it happens, we'll have a lot more to talk about in that regard too. But, you know, there's a lot of like stuff changing with DK and the other app that we've been working on. And I haven't even mentioned any of that stuff yet, but yeah, there's plenty for me to talk about. And none of it's like, I don't mean any of it to be like bad on Elixir. Like, I'm not leaving DK cause I don't want to write Elixir anymore or anything like that. I still really like it. It's just, I've been doing the same thing for what, 4 years now. So started
this is a cool new opportunity, and I'm excited for you.
Yeah
Stay tuned for a lot more shows about Go, apparently.
Maybe we'll see. Again, not set in stone. Knocking on my desk though.
Hey, you can still keep writing Go either way.
Yeah I could. Yeah, definitely could. Yeah, maybe we'll talk about Design Collective next week. What's going on over there? different things.
There's some interesting things going on over there.
Oh yeah, I forgot I told you a little bit about that. That's about all. I guess that's about all I've got for this week.
Is that it? Are you sure?
Yeah. Unless you want to like do another hour.
Listen, we could go another hour if you want.
Corona sessions. No one's driving anyway, right?
Yeah. When do people have time to listen to podcasts if they're not driving, man?
I don't know. Sitting on a bus, sitting on a train. Yeah, people aren't doing that. Oh, I want to say, I guess last thing is I want to say shout out to new friend of the show, Corey. Last week I got a DM on Twitter randomly. he had said, like, hey, you know, I just heard in the show that you moved to Santa Rosa. Like, I live here too. And it turns out we live like 4 or 5 blocks from each other.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So we had a virtual coffee the other morning and like met and just kind of chatted and stuff. And after quarantine dies down a little bit, we might take some walks and things like that. But that's, you know, small world, right? Like, I moved to Vermont and someone was like, hey, I'm here in Vermont. So I had like one friend when I first moved there, and that was from someone that had listened to the show. And now with Santa Rosa, the same thing. Like, I know one person besides my neighbors now, and it's someone that listened to the show. But yeah, I just wanted to say a quick shout out to Corey. Thanks for reaching out, because now I have a friend.
That's awesome.
A friend, an IRL friend, I guess. Yeah.
We've had so much going on. I keep forgetting that you're in Santa Rosa, and I have friends that are there too from my old job.
Oh man.
I gotta make an excuse to come out there, man.
Yeah. You gotta come visit. You can stay on my couch with Watson. It'll be 6 feet. We can stay 6 feet apart.
That's all right. I can be a little spoon.
Watson likes to be the little spoon, so you'll have to spoon him.
He's going to be too big for that soon.
He's already very big. Well, so we used to make him sleep in his kennel at night, because he would take up as much room as... Paul has this theorem that... Given a bed and given a dog, the dog will just naturally expand to take all the room on the bed.
Oh, like the natural gas PV equals NRT?
Yes.
That kind of law?
Watson definitely follows that law.
Hmm.
And it's impossible to sleep through the night, because he literally will get in the middle, lay on his back, fall to one side, and just start kicking with his feet until he has the whole middle of the bed. And like I said, he's an 80-pound dog now. Probably maybe a little more than that. So... it's not okay. So anyway, he was sleeping in his crate for a while. And so now I just started letting him sleep on his bed on the floor, which is next to my side of the bed. And so around 6 o'clock, I'll wake up and there's just eyeballs looking at me. And then when he sees me look at him, he puts one paw on the side. It's like, please. So then I'll say like, all right, come up. And so I'll sleep for a little bit longer when he's like getting his time in the bed, I guess, in the mornings.
Sean, you mush.
What, his eyes are like, his nose is just tall enough when he's sitting, it just like lays perfectly on the bed, so he just looks at you until you wake up.
You gotta stay strong, man. Don't give in.
Yeah, he needs
You're the alpha.
He needs his attention. But, yeah, speaking of, I should probably take him out before he makes a big mess in the kitchen.
Go ahead, you can do your thing now.
But if anyone out there knows about Go, I need you to teach me about it, please. Teach me about interfaces and things. I would love to pair program or talk about Go, or just, I don't know, learn more, share knowledge. I'll teach Elixir in return, I guess.
You're bartering for Go knowledge now?
Yeah.
You can reach Sean on Twitter at Sean Washbot. I'm Shrockwell. Or you can tweet us at the show if you live in Santa Rosa, or you live in the northeastern part of Connecticut. DNC Cast is Twitter.
As always, the show notes are going to be available online. So everything we talked today, I might or might not keep my Go project in. I'm just self-conscious of it right now that I talk about it. But I guess if you want to look at it, there will probably, but maybe not, but most likely be a link to it at dnc.show.
That's fair. It's your prerogative. You do the show notes, so you get the final say in that. We'll also post those show notes, links possibly, over on spectrum.chat. We'll hang out there. If you want to say hi, have a chat, we are there.
And last but not least, thanks to Spec for having us and putting us out into the world, and continuing to have us in light of everything that's going on. It was cool because, you know, they gave us a choice. They texted us and said, hey, you know, if you need a break, let us know. If you need to take some time off, let us know. And we appreciate that they think about that. So, hey, thanks, Spec.
Hey, man. More time at home, more time to listen to podcasts, I think. I hope.
Something like that.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Again, you're not driving, though.
Nope. Oh, I wasn't before.
It's fair.
But I guess the listeners might have been. Anyway, I should probably go take Watson out.
All right. Good boy. You too, Sean.
See ya.
See ya. say Big Spoon, but I said Little Spoon, and you know, it's staying in. Staying in.